Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. As always, Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I talk about depression. We recently returned from the USONA Institute's investigator meeting where we were brought up to speed on the clinical trial they're doing with psilocybin for major depressive disorder, for which we here at Numinous are a site. The meeting inspired me and Reed to reflect on depression a bit and to take a look at research on psilocybin's effects on depression. In this episode, we discuss our own experiences with depression, how depression is defined and diagnosed, what makes depression so-called treatment resistant. We discuss the famous or infamous, depending on who you ask, STAR-D study, explore recent research on what makes psychedelic therapy effective generally, and much, much more. Don't forget, if you're looking for professional training pursuant to becoming a psychedelic assisted practitioner, check out the courses we offer here at Numinous. You can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/training and use the code PTF10 for 10% off selected trainings. If you or someone you know might like to participate in USONA's psilocybin clinical trial for depression or one of the other psychedelic clinical trials we're running here at Numinous, you can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/research to learn more about the trials we're currently running. If you enjoy the show, you can support us by leaving a review or a rating in places like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. If you're watching on YouTube, you can always like the video and share it with somebody you think might like to listen. Without further delay, please enjoy today's episode. So, Reed, I have a question for you as we begin today's recording.
Fire away, Steve.
Reed, have you ever been depressed?
Ooh, interesting question, because depression means a lot of different things, mm-hmm. right? There are normal ups and downs of our mood states day to day, and then there's major depressive disorder.
Right.
So if you're asking me if I've ever had like what we'd call a major depressive episode, I'd say thankfully no. And I realize that that's not perhaps the norm, especially these days. And so, so I also feel a lot of gratitude for that, but also have a hell of a lot of empathy and compassion and as much understanding as I've been able to attain through sitting with hundreds and hundreds of people and hearing about their really deep depressive episodes.
Yeah.
Because it can be rough, but I like to look at our normal day-to-day mood states, of both depression and anxiety, kind of like weather patterns where there are probably a lot of factors playing into it, environmental, hormonal, et cetera, et cetera. And remind myself to let myself feel it too, and remind myself that this will pass and not get caught up in a struggle, or fight against what is, you know what I mean? But how about you, Steve? What's your, personal relationship with depression?
Yeah. So, unfortunately I have, I experienced several major depressive episodes in my youth. And then some in my young adulthood. Thankfully, I haven't experienced anything that would be diagnosed by a clinician as a major depressive episode in many, many years. But like you, I've thought about the difference between what we call major depression and what might be considered normative sadness or grief or melancholy or low energy or, low drive. Lack of interest in things that one might want to normally do, right? These things that sort of make up the diagnostic category that we call depression or major depressive disorder, that in isolation, each one of these so-called symptoms could be quite normative. And so it kind of shows how difficult it is. And we've talked a lot about the struggle with diagnosing things, academic problem with things like the DSM and diagnostic labels and categories. But depression is a slippery one, is an especially slippery one.
Oh yeah. And we can deconstruct that today, but, you mentioned grief and, you know, that is something I'm, well acquainted with, and sadness, of course, and melancholy, but, one thing to add to my little weather pattern analogy is, When looking at grief or many things like this, like sadness and depressed states, if you use this weather pattern analogy and look at the behavior of these cool animals, buffaloes, when there's a storm, buffaloes will go towards it. It might sound counterintuitive, but it actually means they spend less time in the storm because this is coming at them and they're going at it. And what it reminds me is, you've got to let yourself feel things to move through them. And emotions do rise and fall. And the sooner we accept that and the better we get at that, the more efficiently we can move through these states. Sometimes we don't have control over how long one of these weather patterns will last, but sometimes we do. And a lot of that depends on our kind of emotion processing skill, confidence, and style.
So are you saying that that's true of what we're calling normative emotional states, but also non-normative or, pathological, maladaptive emotional states?
You know, there's always a pitfall of fighting against something, whether it's a diagnosable episode or not, but I'm more applying this to the normal ups and downs or depressed moods and episodes of grief or bereavement that we all go through.
And listeners to the show have heard us use lots of common phrases to describe this. What you resist persists, right?
Yeah,
you have to feel it to heal it, all these things that fun slogans, but they speak to a deeper truth.
Yeah. And you mentioned how hard it is to diagnose or how tricky it is to diagnose depression. Just, I've been thinking that a lot lately when I see all these varying statistics, especially post COVID, it's been reported on a lot. The rates of anxiety and depression have been increasing. And, I believe that's true and it makes sense for a lot of reasons. But it is hard to pinpoint, what is the true prevalence, incidence of depression in a given population. But the most recent thing I read, it was like a Gallup poll that said about 30% of Americans reported having been diagnosed with depression in their lifetime. But and you may see numbers like 1 in 7 to 1 in 10 will be diagnosed with major depressive disorder or a major depressive episode. And it's higher in certain age groups, for example, like especially young people, especially post COVID, that was like age 19 to maybe 30 was the age group that got hit with the highest increase.
Yeah. Prevalent statistics always fascinate me because I'm always curious about how depression has been measured over the decades. Is it the same kinds of questionnaires? Are they looking at the same kind of symptoms? Even the definitions for what constitutes a major depressive episode have changed, over the last 100 years or whatever. So, and similar questions are asked about other conditions, the prevalence of other conditions like autism spectrum disorders or whatever. So
yeah,
it makes me curious about what the data are actually saying, it has been said there are lies, damn lies and statistics, but I think anybody, if you just check in with your own lived experience and the people that you know, and what you're gathering from, albeit imperfectly, from social media, most people would probably say, it seems like misery is on the rise.
Yeah. Depression is one of the worst things, I think. And one of the worst parts of it, in my opinion, is what we would call clinically anhedonia or basically the phenomenon that occurs in depression that sucks the joy and pleasure out of things,
right?
Like unable to enjoy things you used to enjoy. And that ranges from your hobbies to food to relationship joys as well.
Yeah. And we see a correlation between a few symptoms of depression and suicidal ideation. And anhedonia is one. The other is perceived burdensomeness, when people feel like they're a burden to those around them, sense of worthlessness, and of course, purposelessness. Feel like there's no hope.
Yeah. So the hopelessness part of depression is one of the things that I like to target the most as a clinician, because it is also tied to that, suicidal ideation and suicide risk, but it's something like there are two big things going on in depression, to oversimplify it, is one, feeling hopeless in that you feel like you're alone in it, or like no one else might feel this way. And two, you feel like it'll never get better. And if we can get in there with someone and help them, one, feel like they aren't alone, and help them like both be with them, and but also help them understand that what's going on, and that this is not their fault. This is not a weakness. This is not laziness. This is a person suffering, something that happened, and it will pass. We are there. We're going to do everything we can to help them get through it. And it's called a major depressive episode for a reason, even though there's a wide range, like 2 weeks to 2 years or more.
Right.
Most of them, in my experience, are not 2 year episodes. Some are, and that's awful. And we want to do everything we can to intervene, but there is an episodic nature. It will pass. And sometimes we really need to, look for whatever glimmers of hope we can get to bring in to help the individual ride out the storm.
Right. Yes, you're talking about a change in perspective occasioned by, you know, connection with somebody who can help someone who's in the pit of despair.
Yeah.
See something broader than just sort of that little circle of light above their pit. So we'll talk about it in a bit, but what you're describing is part of why I'm really excited about psychedelic assisted therapy for depression.
Yeah.
And you know, the etiology of depression, what causes major depressive disorder, is as varied as the symptoms that we're discussing, because it seems like there are many roads that lead to depression. And you were talking about impact. I think major depressive disorder is like the leading cause of disability.
Yeah. Worldwide.
In America or worldwide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like 300+ million people.
Well, and depression often runs with other things, right? You know, people who are diagnosed with depression often have pain conditions. They often have anxiety. They often have trauma. They often have
substance use.
They're more likely to be diagnosed with like fibromyalgia or
cardiovascular concerns, etc. And it goes two ways, right? Like, you know, if you have a cardiovascular disease, your depression rate increases substantially. Diabetes, same thing, but also depression preceding those. And we don't understand, as a disclaimer, these relationships in a crystal clear way,
right?
But there is something going on there.
Yeah. And it also sort of begs the question, again, back to etiology. You were talking about this, you know, this lack of hope and this struggle to maintain a hopeful perspective. You could make the argument that these are like the cognitive roots, and maybe there's a bidirectional arrow there. But then, you know, what are the physiological correlates? What's going on in somebody's brain? People have heard about the chemical imbalance or the serotonin hypothesis of depression.
Yeah. You know, I like to geek out on the history of things, including the history of depression, among many other things. But back in like the 5th century BC, Hippocrates had this theory that depression was caused by black bile secreted by the spleen. And
imbalance of the humors.
Yeah, and that resulted in melancholy, or melancholia, they would call it. But then in the Middle Ages, depression was thought to be a result of demon possession. Mm-hmm. And if some people, especially women, and this is like tragic and shocking, like when depressed, were thought to be witches and then killed because of it. So yeah, like the ideas and understanding of it has been all over the place through the ages. And it wasn't until like the 17th century that this idea came along that it's a condition linked to the brain. But I sometimes think about this serotonergic, oversimplified hypothesis, and how there were some pivotal papers in the last year or two that have challenged that, and how one day we might look on it and laugh that we thought, you know, depression was a serotonin thing.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, we might view it not unlike we view the black bile.
Yeah.
As an oversimplification.
Yeah. But yeah, so depression is, Yeah, I mean, probably the most common thing we see in clinic, and it means a lot of different things. You mentioned psychedelic assisted therapy, and I know we'll get into that more and more, but just to add that it's important to look at what the studies were treating. Like, it's very different to treat cancer related depression or end of life anxiety as another example, than it is to try and treat treatment resistant depression. Someone's depression of unknown etiology, or maybe from a number of different factors. Maybe there's even some childhood trauma played in, some history of other conditions, physical and mental health playing into the mix. But it's very different to target those. And then in the middle, we have this kind of classic major depressive disorder and all these offshoots like postpartum depression. 10% of women after they deliver a baby have serious depression.
Right.
And that is a different thing. Psychotic depression, depression with psychotic features, another, slightly different but related subtype.
Complicated bereavement, right? Like,
yeah.
But this label of treatment resistant depression fascinates me in part because we've been doing some studies, at Numinous for psilocybin for treatment resistant depression versus psilocybin for major depressive disorder. But the way, at least in the lab, that treatment resistant depression gets defined is somebody who hasn't had a successful response to at least two discrete antidepressant trials.
Yeah, that's the way insurance companies will define it. It's not in the diagnostic and statistical manual, treatment resistant depression, just like cancer related depression is not a DSM diagnosis per se, but those are, they're important kind of definitions in terms of doing studies on specific conditions and getting coverage for specific things. Like we work a lot with Spravato or esketamine, FDA approved for treatment-resistant depression, meaning in order to get Spravato and get it paid for by your insurance, if you have it, you have to have tried and had an inadequate response or treatment failure, if you will, that can include not able to tolerate it, but treatment failure to two or more antidepressants.
I gotta say, I hate the term treatment failure.
Yeah.
And I know you do too, or even treatment resistant depression. For me, a more compassionate, maybe even more accurate term would be depression for which our current treatments are terrible. Current treatments suck.
That would place more of the responsibility where responsibility is due, right? We are not that good at treating some kinds of depression, lots of kinds of depression. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the understanding of this, if you have gone through med school or a psychology grad program, or probably even in undergrad courses, sometimes you might encounter the STAR-D study, but it was this one of a few pivotal studies that was funded by the government in large part, $60 million, and rather than industry sponsored, and looked at what percent of people respond to their first antidepressant versus the second versus the third. And so a lot of our TRD statistics come from that. Mm. And there have been dozens of papers published as a follow-up. And also important to point out that like many things these days, it is getting heavily debated and, not canceled, if you will, but debated, of how robust are these statistics and conclusions that are widely cited, given the study design that some people are really dissecting and debating.
And sort of one of the dissections and debates about the STAR-D trial is that a lot of the data come from pharma companies who were accused of or discovered that were not reporting on some of the less encouraging findings for the negative findings.
It's actually not a pharma bias in this case. The reason, one of the reasons why STAR-D has been so widely cited is because it was
government funded.
Yeah, it was government funded and done in largely primary care clinics.
So they weren't looking at pharma. They were looking data?
They collected the data. The problem is the way the data was collected. Just to give an example, there are these bullet points of things that are that people are raising concern about, like the way that people who didn't follow up to their appointments were treated. Mm. Like study design in clinical trials through the years has really progressed. Yeah. And there are international standards and
more
things.
Rigorous.
Yeah, it's very much so, and more ethical, of course. Mm. There are some terrible examples from many decades ago. But the STAR*D data, because it was closer to the real world and in these clinics that might not have been clinical trial shops, and some of the protocol nuances, like if someone doesn't follow up, what do you call that? Maybe they didn't follow up because they didn't respond well and they hated it. So how do we factor that into the response rate? But maybe it's worth summarizing, like, just the 2-minute summary of what people like to cite from STAR*D is that in the initial paper came out in 2006, Trivedi et al., I think, the first line antidepressant had a remission rate, and remission means getting your depression score down to normal range, mm-hmm. not zero, but normal range, was 37%. And then after you take a second antidepressant, if you didn't respond well to the first, the remission rate was 31%. And then after you take a third, it's 14%. But what was interesting about that is they also followed, how many people relapse back into a depression episode after doing well? And after those who had just had one treatment attempt in this study, you know, 40% relapse rate, an average of 4 months to relapse into another episode. Concerning, but mm-hmm. it gets worse if you're on your second trial of an antidepressant, the relapse rate is 55%, and it happens sooner, like 3.9 months. If you're on your third antidepressant trial, 65% of people relapsed, and at an average of 3 months later. So the relapse rate is increasing as you have more treatment attempts, and the time to relapse is shortening, kind of highlighting how hard treatment-resistant depression is to have right. or to treat.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's some question, and you'd know better than me, but some question about, like, well, what is it? What's going on with these folks that makes their depression resistant to these, what we've already described as like not great treatments anyway. And you know, we've noticed this in some of our psychedelic clinical trials. Like, if you don't respond really well to an antidepressant, and you're tried on a second, you're tried on a third, you're also accumulating a lot of side effects, or even the term side effect kind of bugs me. It's like the effects of the drug that suck.
Yeah. Adverse events.
Adverse response.
Adverse effects.
And it's still doing something to your brain chemistry. And coming off of these medicines, which a lot of people have to do in order to get into our psychedelic clinical trials, for example, mm-hmm. can be harrowing. And it might be responsible for, you know, some of the relapse into major depressive disorder or episodes.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point. And, you know, this is just another possible factor to throw in the mix, is the placebo response. If you look at depression studies, like pharma-sponsored depression studies that say get something like Prozac or Cymbalta approved, there is a placebo response in the placebo group that's not trivial. Like, it can be 20%+, right. or an average of, say, 10-point drop on the gold standard clinician-administered scale, which is the MADRS, or a Montgomery-Åsberg depression rating scale, the one we use in all our depression studies, including the psychedelic ones. It's often now done by a central rater who is independent and very blinded and unbiased, doesn't know the patient,
right.
and their, you know, wasn't involved in their prep and integration and all that. But, and I think that's, even though it's a pain to coordinate, I think it's a good strategy.
If you're trying to eliminate as much, you know, bias, which is present in these studies, that's a good way to do it.
Yeah. So that's how, MAPS did their PTSD rating scales. The CAPS-5 raters would be a centralized team, mm-hmm. like trained by Frank, who wrote the scale at the VA, I think in Boston or wherever, and his group, really doing careful, consistent ratings remotely on video. But yeah, the placebo response, to get back to my original point, is maybe diminishing the hope that the next treatment may be helpful, could understandably diminish as you're getting more discouraged with the options out there. And we'll take, as clinicians, we'll take response wherever it can come from. Like, placebo response is not a bad thing. Like, if you want to, the bad version of that we'd call the nocebo response, like the opposite direction, like believing something might be harmful and therefore it's leading to some less desirable effects, mm-hmm. or some worsening. But to get, say, a 5 or 10 point drop on your depression score from placebo, great. The question the FDA wants to know is, what is the difference between the placebo group and the drug group? And was it better than placebo enough, sufficiently better to warrant approving it and safe, of course?
Yeah. Statistically and or clinically significant differences. And some studies that show that those differences, if they exist, are not really big. There are a few studies that around psychotherapy, certain kinds of psychotherapy, especially in combination with psychotropic drugs, that show even better outcomes and better and more durable improvements.
So, and it's important to, when you're reading a study of depression intervention, psychotherapy or med or TMS or electroshock or ketamine, whatever, you'll often see both response rates and remission rates. Mm-hmm. And response means, in general, most people's definition would be, response means your depression score went down by a half or more. And remission means it got down to that normal range, say on the MADRS 0 to 7 or something like that. Because it's normal, expected, common to have fluctuations in your mood day to day. And some, like, it would be very uncommon to have someone have a 0 on their depression rating scale.
Right.
So that's...
That's star D.
Yeah, that's star D. And that's what people cite most about the TRD stats, but it's certainly relevant in, like I mentioned, the Spravato work we do. We're involved in work with Compass Pathways and their psilocybin drug development path and phase 3 work for TRD, treatment resistant depression, and mm-hmm. and we've been working with USONA for quite some time, first in phase 2 and now kicking off phase 3 for MDD, although there is a subset who, you know, will be allowed to have TRD in this next study.
Yeah. So we actually just got back from the investigator meeting in Madison, Wisconsin for USONA.
Yeah. That's where USONA it was, right? Headquarters. Yes. It was in Wisconsin, not the easiest place to get to, but worth the trek. Cause wow, what an organization and what a facility.
Oh yeah. Such a cool campus. I mean, it's just an architectural work of art. It was fun to wander around there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We spent a lot of time under the coolest lamp.
The LED chandelier,
that's ever been created that responds to music and seems to be alive. Like, talk about what AI would look like. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's what I was thinking as we were lounging under that lamp for a while in their kind of group ceremony room.
Yeah. I mean, it was not unlike some of the things I've seen on certain consciousness altering plant compounds. It was pretty psychedelic.
Machine elves.
Yeah.
In the chandelier. Yeah. But such a neat group, because they're a nonprofit organization, mm-hmm. with this fast track designation from the FDA granted for their psilocybin drug development pathway, and trying to bring it to market, bring it to people who need it as a clinical tool. And what's been tested mostly is a single dose of psilocybin with psychological support, mm-hmm. for MDD.
Right. And in their study design, they're doing more than one dose. At least the,
now it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Now it is, right? It's for phase three.
Yeah. And that's become, thankfully, the norm. That was really a concern to, I think, all of us in the earlier phases, but, and it was mostly an FDA decision saying, no, you can't have an open label. Open label meaning, okay, you had this placebo versus drug part of your study. How about we give everyone the drug after? Mm-hmm. And because, you know, we can learn some things from that. It's a nice thing to do. Someone is depressed. They come into a study and volunteer and they get placebo and we can't offer them the real drug. It was hard. Yeah. You know, it was a necessary thing, I think, that we all had to do. But thankfully in these later phases, there's an open label component where, you know, if someone's depression returns, even though we won't know if they had depression, if they had placebo or psilocybin, if their depression returns, we can intervene with a psilocybin dose where they know what they're getting. We know what they're getting.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it also allows the researchers to ask and answer some other interesting questions beyond the primary endpoint, right?
Yeah.
So you've got the primary endpoint after the double blind period, like do their depression scores go down? But then we can ask, like, you know, other questions. What are their perceived well-being scores like? Or how about, you know, mystical experience or emotional breakthrough or whatever? Mm-hmm. So yeah, more opportunities to collect more data on interesting questions.
And what's the durability of a response? Like, how long does it really last? There have been some studies published on this, like, you know, a single dose of psilocybin plus psychological support, especially some of the early studies from Imperial College in the UK showing that, yeah, for a large number of people, there is a lasting response, but these were small studies. And, you know, I think the psychedelic world certainly needs more kind of robust, well-done studies to shine a light on, like, who should get what and and how.
Yeah, and, you know, we started the conversation talking about how depression manifests in a lot of different ways. And, you know, one of the Imperial College studies on TRD with psilocybin, two doses, 10 milligrams, 25 milligrams, there was rapid response, which is almost the case across the board with these psilocybin studies for depression, even TRD. You get a rapid response in a lot of the participants, but then depression scores creep back up. And you compare that to the cancer studies with psilocybin, where, you know, cancer-related or existential-related distress, anxiety and depression, rapid response, and they maintain it over sometimes years if they're still alive, right? Some of these folks end up passing away and we can't collect that data, but so it's just interesting, right? You have quote unquote depression in both populations, but different responses to this intervention, probably dealing with a different phenomenon.
Yeah. Like we were saying earlier, cancer related depression, while like not insignificant, like someone has cancer and they're, you know, they have this extremely scary diagnosis and maybe a life expectancy that is frightening,
right,
and just rocks their world. You know, not to trivialize that one bit, but it certainly seems to be more amenable to intervening with a single dose of psilocybin, helping the vast majority of people. Like that's, and it also seems to be quite different than treating someone's treatment-resistant depression. That's why you have like the Roland Griffiths studies of cancer-related depression or end-of-life related kind of depression, anxiety, having these amazing results. And then the headlines, say last year, on some of the psilocybin phase two studies, like from Compass, saying like, did it beat the SSRI? Yes, no. There's some debate out there, and it, and maybe we can dive into those a little bit.
Yeah. For me, the difference between the outcomes of those patient populations has me wondering, like, what is psilocybin doing for the cancer patient that it's not doing for the TRD patient? You know, and we have these things that people experience on psilocybin that are, have correlated with outcomes, like the experience, what we call the mystical experience, or an emotional breakthrough. I referenced those measures a second ago. And, you know, the mystical experience, it's not a hard conceptual leap to see that if somebody who is afraid of dying has an experience on psilocybin where they feel that their death is put into perspective, or, yeah, you know, that death is not the end. Or, you know, there was one case report where a person in their psilocybin experience, cancer came down and sat down at the dinner table with them.
Yeah.
Like, oh, cancer's part of me. It's part of my life. I don't have to view it as the enemy that's going to end me.
That's a paper you can look up too. Cancer at the Dinner Table. I think Cody Smith wrote it. Yeah.
Yeah. So perspective granting, which we talk about a lot, is one of the perhaps active ingredients here in what helps people get well after experiencing a psychedelic like psilocybin. But yeah, for whatever reason, those kinds of insights, those kinds of experiences, if people with TRD are having them, they don't lead to the type of durable response that it's leading to in these people with cancer-related depression.
Yeah, because those Hopkins studies, like by Roland Griffiths, for example, published in 2016, and then there was another one, I don't know how to say their name, Libus or something, the 2022 study, but the average depression scores going into those cancer-related depression studies was high, but they also hadn't had a lifelong history of depression. It's sometimes I think about it in a similar way to treating a single incident, single event trauma versus a complex PTSD, developmental trauma, since childhood. Although the MAPS data did include a lot of that and still did quite well on helping resolve PTSD in many people. But 6 months later, after these cancer-related depression studies, the majority still in remission, 4 to 5 years later, still over half in remission. And that's why the New York Times back then was citing things like one dose of a hallucinogen and lasting peace.
Yeah. Lasting peace cures depression.
Yeah. And, you know, it was a time of the beginning of the hype cycle. Yes. But it was also, a much more targetable condition, than say TRD that some of the clinical trials are working on now.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So you were talking about maybe diving into this, does psilocybin outperform, what was it? Escitalopram was the antidepressant they were studying.
So at this meeting, Chuck Raison or Charles Raison gave a great overview, and he's a brilliant psychiatrist researcher and pivotal part of the USONA studies.
Yeah, he's their director of clinical and translational research at
USONA. Yeah, and I always love hearing him speak. I think we may have first heard him at the Horizons Conference a couple of years back in New York, and I was taking copious notes back then, but he gave a great fly through while we were at the USONA meeting. So we want to give a nice shout out to him, because I think you had pointed out to me his journalism background, right?
I heard him on Chantel Thomas's podcast, Blind Spots, and learned he has like an interest in tummo breathing and meditation and doing these studies on trying to anesthetize people and give them psychedelics to see if the actual remembered or experienced phenomenology of a psychedelic experience is important for outcomes, and we're trying to give it to them while they're asleep. Just interesting studies. But yeah, I think he's got a journalism background, and if you listen to him lecture, you know, he does a really good job of telling a story with the data.
Excuse me. Yeah. I think he mentioned out there on that IV psilocybin while people sleep study that the first couple of people they'd given it to woke right up. It's pretty funny.
Their heart rate shot up. Yeah.
Made me curious, like, ooh, if you stuck some mushrooms in my mouth, Steve, while I'm sleeping, how long would it take me to wake up?
Well, you sleep like the dead, so I don't know.
Yeah.
You might sleep right through.
I wonder.
Yeah.
I heard, Rick Doblin say in a Zoom call once, he was telling a story about once when he took some LSD and sat back in his recliner on purpose to take a nap, and then just let it wake him up, and then boom, he just woke up ready to go.
Yeah, that one man lab, Rick Doblin.
Yeah, but a thank you to Chuck for all his work and his skilled storytelling around these things. But to rewind to some of the early depression studies, we talked about cancer-related depression, right? So if we're looking at MDD or TRD, I think a Robin Carhart-Harris study published in 2016, another in 2018, were the first real depression clinical trials, but they were open label, meaning no
placebo group.
Yeah, not double blind, placebo controlled. But they did see, unlike the cancer study, some depression creep back in over 6 months, some loss of effect. So over the 20 people, small study, like 6 restarted meds after 3 months, 5 went back to therapy, 5 went and found psilocybin somehow. And so pretty much everyone's depression returned in some way eventually, which is like, it's just important to state the parts of the research studies that are often glanced over as people are
enthusiastic.
Yeah, understandably. But you know, I think we both firmly believe in providing balanced, like, information about these topics. I think it's important for a sustainable path forward. Like, let's talk about the risks as much as we talk about the benefits, right? Or let's make sure we have the whole picture.
Right. What's the point of doing science if you're going to report biased results?
Yeah. And interestingly, in clinical trials, traditionally, the FDA didn't require drug companies to, you know, publish their failed trials, and there'd be data filed away. And there was a researcher, you know, a few years back who went in and finally got access to some of those. And there was an average of like 7 studies done, but just 2 positive ones needed for approval of a drug. And it was kind of sobering to see some of the mixed results that have come out of a lot of these antidepressant studies through the years. I think the consensus is they still work better in general. If you're summarizing across these studies, work better than placebo, but it's not the effect size we would desire.
It's not super impressive. Yeah.
And I've also got to give the disclaimer that I've prescribed a lot of traditional antidepressants over the years to people. And I would say that in some cases it's been life-saving. Oh, yeah. It's an important tool in the toolkit to have, but the way I view them is they're an intervention for a time when needed. Almost, I've used this analogy before, but like giving someone an SSRI, I view it's like putting the emotional system of an individual in a cast and letting things heal for a time. For example, compare that to a psilocybin approach, working on serotonin receptors as well, but in a very different way, where it's triggering a kind of a flood of emotional release or emotional connection, like a completely different mechanism. But neither are miracle cures.
Right.
And depression, especially treatment-resistant depression, does seem to return for many, if not most people, looking at some of those early studies, even after a dose of psilocybin.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what about that Carr and Harris study that the headline was psilocybin doesn't really do much more than this particular antidepressant?
So the study that looked at Lexapro and psilocybin was a Carhart-Harris study done, published at least in 2021, New England Journal. So it was separate from this open label one I was just reporting on, and separate from the Compass phase 2B that was published, 2022? But that was an interesting one that caused a lot of debate, because it was a randomized controlled trial, 60 people, psilocybin and Lexapro groups. And if you look at just the scores of, they used a different measure than we were talking about. They used the QIDS-SR, like the STAR-D did, actually. Mm-hmm. They used that. And if you're looking at the drop in points on your depression scale, psilocybin did better, but it might have been like 10-point drop versus 8-point drop in the Lexapro group. The response and remission rates look quite a bit better for psilocybin versus the Lexapro group. So great data to have. There was some debate because I think people wanted, expected, hoped psilocybin to just
knock Lexapro out of the water. Yeah.
Yeah. Just to blow up treatment as usual. Mm-hmm. But it did highlight the fact that these are difficult conditions to both study and treat. And psilocybin is not necessarily a one and done magic intervention for depression.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when I heard Chuck talk about this study, he actually did some of his own digging, and he looked, because mm-hmm. they didn't just do the quids, they did a bunch of other measures. And yeah. the New England Journal of Medicine, I guess, wasn't really interested in them reporting on a lot of that other data.
They get pretty picky.
Yeah. So Chuck went and mined the data and had a statistician look at it and said that there were actually some improvements on some other scales that where psilocybin outperformed Lexapro, like just reports of general psychological well-being, for example, which is different than, you know,
yeah,
depression.
Yeah. So if you kind of tease apart some of the parts of the study that were less reported on, you can really see where psilocybin has some advantages in tolerability in certain areas of life and sexual dysfunction, etc. But the New England Journal takes a stance like the research world needs to do in some ways of like, no, you state your hypothesis beforehand.
Right.
And we're going to report on that. And that's same with the FDA, like, you know, you're doing a study design, you want to get a drug approved. What is your primary outcome? Mm-hmm. Is a change in this scale at this time point compared to placebo? And if it doesn't hit that, thumbs down, like failed study.
Yeah, I get it. Like we said before, we're trying to control for one of the sources of bias that plagues studies like this, and that's the expectancy bias, right? When we really, really hope for an outcome, we can have an unconscious or deliberate bias that affects the way the data that it's themselves, but also the way we report mm-hmm. on those data. So it makes sense.
It's not that the other stuff isn't important. It's extremely important, and it's called like secondary aims mm-hmm. or instead of your primary outcome measure, it might be your secondary measures or your exploratory aims or outcomes. And we learned so much from those, like we're talking about earlier, the mystical experience, etc. In terms of the go, no go of a drug approval and, you know, some of the standards for publishing these days, they get pretty strict on state a priori in advance your hypothesis and let's test it.
Yeah.
And then let's see what happens. We need it all, and we need good quality research, and it's also fun and useful and helpful to reanalyze this later and help design the next studies.
Yeah. Right?
So that was the head to head, and then came Compass's phase 2B that was published in 2022, Goodwin et al. And that was their TRD study, right? And so that one, let me see if I've got it handy. 25 milligrams, single dose of psilocybin, 12-week study. The placebo group was actually 1 milligram of psilocybin. Mm. There was a 10 milligram dose, like a medium or semi-active dose group, and then a 25 milligram, which was their main intervention that is that they're developing. The 25 milligrams being what, like roughly 3 or 4 dried grams of mushrooms, depending on a lot of factors, strain, potency, etc. Another interesting part of that study is they let people resume antidepressants after this primary outcome was tested 3 weeks in. And so we get to see from the paper the rates of how many people resumed an antidepressant on the high dose and versus the medium dose versus the low. And, you know, it was maybe 5% got back on an antidepressant in the high dose and 20% in the 1 milligram group. And over the 6 weeks, after 6 weeks, the first 6 weeks of the study, as they followed people over time, a lot of people's depression did return. Mm-hmm. And this was TRD, but right. it did come back, as you might expect, like we've been talking about.
Right, right. So yeah, lots of promise, but reasons to be cautious and still do good hard science.
Yeah, One more study to mention, because it was Chuck's study that he, and I got to be a co-author on that, having been the PI of that phase two study, which was a really neat experience because he's so sharp in this. I think he mentioned at the meeting that there were 87 comments that came back from JAMA after we submitted the paper. And his response, you know, that he'd circulated to all the authors and we'd get to chime in, but he was really driving the ship in a really, in a kind of courageous and bold and sharp way. Was his response was like 40, 50 pages. Wow. And it got published in JAMA last fall. And that was USONA's phase two, looking at MDD, not TRD, using also a single dose of 25 milligram. That you were on that study as a facilitator as well, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. And being on these studies, working with these medicines, it if you don't mind a pivot here into a different path, like always has me wondering, what is it? What is it about the psilocybin experience, I guess, in this case, that is so helpful for people? We've touched on it a little bit in this conversation, but I saw a couple studies recently that were kind of fascinating in answering this question, or at least providing some new provocative ideas about what it might be about specifically psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy that is so helpful. Because we talked about the head-to-head trials of psilocybin with you know, Lexapro. One of the things that traditional antidepressants tend to do that people don't like, that psilocybin doesn't tend to do, is cause emotional blunting.
Yeah.
Right. So there was this interesting study about what is it that might sort of mediate or modulate the effects of sort of the psilocybin effects and then the result in decreased depression. So one of them was the Therapeutic Alliance. This is by Roberta Murphy et al. In 2022. Therapeutic Alliance and Rapport modulate responses to psilocybin-assisted therapy for depression. And the short story is that the strength of the therapeutic rapport, the therapeutic relationship, measured by a couple of different measures, it modulated, or in this case, modulated the response, meaning that there were two different trials, two different dosing sessions, and if both therapists and participants rated the therapeutic relationship as high before the first medicine session, then they were likely to have better outcomes.
Yeah.
They were likely also to have greater emotional breakthrough as measured by the emotional breakthrough inventory, and more potent mystical experiences, which I just thought was super fascinating.
It's cool that was looked at, because it does make sense intuitively, but that's the thing. We need to test all these hypotheses and assumptions and factor them into, you know, the results, our understanding of it, and like, who might this be helpful for and why, right? And it's one of the factors, not to say that a low, you know, therapeutic rapport with someone means they won't have a good outcome, but more likely to... understandably, right?
Yeah. And like you said, it also is intuitive. It kind of makes sense, because at least the way most of us are approaching psychedelic assisted work is, you know, us as the space holders, as the therapists, are trying to create an environment of safety, an environment where you feel supported, where, you know, you're not doing this by yourself, an environment of connection and compassion. And if, you know, those things are what's going to be amplified, if we continue to call psychedelics non-specific amplifiers, you can imagine why that would then translate to improvements in depression scores.
Yeah. The more you can begin with a sense of safety and comfort, the better, right?
Yeah. And that you're not in it alone. Like, we're asking people to, like you said at the beginning of the conversation, move through and to, instead of like away from, uncomfortable experiences. For me, it's a lot easier to do that if I've got somebody's hand to hold a little bit, or if I got some encouragement, some hope.
Yeah. And I think this isn't unique to psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. And we've talked about on here before, like, is psychological support psychotherapy necessary? Yes, no. And, you and I both worked on the MindMed LSD study as well, which was for anxiety, with a single dose of LSD. And I remember, you know, having got to be a facilitator as well as, you know, PI that study, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah, it's kind of uncommon.
Was When people would come in for the first time meeting the dosing session monitors, because they had generalized anxiety disorder and because they were going into this psychedelic dosing session in the coming days, I remember, even though we were clearly instructed no psychotherapy, this is not a psychotherapy component, these are dosing session monitors, I remember paying attention to that. Like, how are they feeling? Just trying to tune into their level of anxiety with me or us as facilitators and the room. And we give them a tour and we'd, understandably, it's all things that you wouldn't not do. But they do, they're worth pointing out, they're worth studying, they're worth investigating and debating. Right. But it is intuitive that we want someone to feel safe before going into these things.
Right.
And interestingly, on non-psychedelic clinical trials, this placebo response is always something, it's always a huge factor that people are paying attention to. So I've had, countless, sessions of instruction on minimizing the placebo response. And like years ago, it used to be recommended like, oh, you might want to be not too warm in your presence. You might want to put a white coat on and be like, nah, or things like that, which, understandable. You've got to kind of be able to pinpoint that response and keep it in, keep it consistent and, measurable and all that. But, it is funny some of the ways that we've looked at doing that through the years.
Yeah. Trying to take human connection variables out of, a disorder that is likely, at least in part, the result of breaks in human connection or people feeling alone or oppressed or harmed. Yeah, it is kind of funny. One of the other studies I wanted to just highlight real quick that I thought was fascinating is one by Alan Davis et al. 2020. Psychological flexibility mediates the relations between acute psychedelic effects and subjective decreases in depression and anxiety. So this is just another one, like, well, what is being changed in the mind that then translates into better depression, but better outcomes on depression scores. And this one was, people are less dogmatic in their mind about the things that they believe that end up torturing them. Mm-hmm. So they go from that sort of less flexible to more flexible. And I think in this study, they even had a therapeutic intervention that was patterned after acceptance and commitment therapy that talks a lot about that difference between psychologically inflexible or fused people and defused people. But just not to drone on too much, it just fascinates me.
That is. And it reminds me of one kind of thing that we are able to look at from the USONA, the Raison et al. JAMA paper was the impact of preparation on like response and emotional blunting. I think Chuck mentioned some of it, like looking at some of those measures, we're able to see that the prep was not the miracle cure itself, right? Even though like what you were saying earlier about the therapeutic alliance is important and a mediator, that's not the main event. Yeah.
Well, Reed, we've covered a lot of ground today. I guess we kind of nerded out a little bit more than we usually do on the show, at least as of late, talking about a lot of studies, but
showing our true
nerdy colors.
Yep. And I do worry about waxing too technical and scientific in some of these, but this is important data. Mm-hmm. And even if we didn't do the most clear and concise job of conveying it, I think the point is it's an important time in psychedelic research to do good quality studies and interpret them in a sound way and not get ahead of ourselves in the conclusions, just continuing to shine a light on these areas that need it for the path forward.
Well, we decided to name our show Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, right? Mm-hmm. And so the research is part of what constitutes the frontier of psychedelic therapy. So forgive us for being a little nerdy. Hopefully some of you enjoyed this trip down empirical study lane. If not, you can always email us and tell us how to do better. But thanks for listening, folks. Thanks for the conversation, Reed. Until next time. Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel, like the videos, and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.